Case number 055117 et al. Khalid A.F. Aloda, next friend of Fazi Khalid Abdullah Fahad Aloda et al. Versus United States of America appellants. Mr. Flinchy for the appellants, Mr. Reams for the appellees.
May it please the court, I'm August Fungi with the Justice Department. With me at council tables, Robert Loeb and Doug Letter with the Justice Department also. The legal issue here should be quite simple. The parties in supplemental briefing have agreed that this court's holding in Bismula sets the appropriate standard for the filing of highly sensitive classified information with the court ex parte in these habeas cases. Under that standard, counsel will generally be provided with the classified material in habeas factual returns.
Before we get into the substance, we were alerted by our super secret internal information system called SCOTUS blog. I take it some other people have the same system, that there was a case management order by Judge Hogan yesterday. Yeah. And the question that we have, and we don't have any answer for it, is whether this affects either the finality of the order ordering the government to produce the classified information, or whether or moots it. That is, has anything overtaken? This order is quite old now, right?
Yes, it's from January 2005.
Right. So, are those orders continuing, regardless of the fact that there's a new case management judge and new judges specifically assigned to the cases, or does the government have an opportunity under what you described as a slightly different set of rules, procedural rules about treatment of the classified information, to go to that district judge now and determine whether you can do the kind of back and forth that you understand Bismula to provide?
On the mootness issue, the order at issue on appeal here is not moot. It requires turning over certain factual returns that were already filed in the district court in 2004 and early 2005. So unless that order is reversed, it will require that classified information be turned over to opposing counsel. As far as finality, I think it's still final for that same reason. I mean, it still is operative on those factual returns. As far as practical impact going forward, I think it's limited. The Hogan order applies in all these cases, I think, going forward with respect to amended factual returns. The government is filing amended factual returns and has done so in I think, all but three or four of the cases that are on appeal here. But at the same time, the Hogan order leaves a real ambiguity on whether Bismula is appropriate for the habeas cases. And given that the parties in this litigation have said that Bismula provides an operative standard that is workable, we submit that this court should order that standard should be applied in this case. And given the fast pace of the district court proceedings, we ask the court to do so quickly, with all respect.
But your bottom line on the question I'm asking is that it doesn't affect the outstanding order that you have.
It doesn't. Okay. We don't think it affects the outstanding order.
Go ahead.
Again, so since the parties agree on the legal standard in Bismula would be appropriate for handling highly sensitive information where most of the classified information is provided to counsel, but some especially sensitive information can be provided that the government determines is too sensitive to provide to counsel can be provided to the court ex parte. Given that the
is it your view that the Bismula order means that this sensitive information goes to the court in camera and that's it, or do you anticipate that something further can happen with that information, that in effect the court can decide it needs to be disclosed?
We would submit that there are a variety of steps that this court has used in the past in dealing with this sort of a situation. None of those steps were followed here, and there's a series of them. Under Stillman, which the Bismoola order cited, the district court has to first decide whether it can resolve the case without the assistance of plaintiff's counsel, in spite of the ex parte material. Under other cases, the court can ask for further justification on why this material is too sensitive to pass along. Hamdi suggested that the record can include summaries made by military officials, and so a summary or a substitution could be considered for material. And of course, the court has to consider if the information is even material to the case. There are not a lot of redactions. If you look at the record here, I think there are only 8 documents with redactions in the four or five factual returns involving detainees who are still at Guantanamo. So it's not a substantial amount of material, at least in those cases.
When you say you're talking about particularly sensitive information, that's only one of the 2 categories that were redacted. The list of other detainees or other people who were at the camps, for example. And I'm not in any way referring to classified information. I'm only referring to the information in your brief and in the other side's brief. So you describe the situation where a super secret source says the detainee plus 10 other individuals were at an al-Qaeda training camp, right?
Yes.
The super secret part is the source. The fact that that source says that the detainee plus 10 others were at a camp, the fact of the 10 others, you are not describing as super sensitive. You're describing that as not pertaining to the detainee, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so what's the explanation? That's a whole different set of arguments about, so I'll put aside the super sensitive part. The detainee's lawyers argue that those other people may be witnesses who will testify that, in fact, their clients were not at the camp. And there's no way for the court to know whether that's true or not, or to know whether it's material or not, because the court has no idea what the detainee or the detainee's lawyers know about the detainee's relationship, for example, with those other 10 people. So what's the point of the category of excluding everybody other than the detainee listed at the camp?
I think 2 responses. As an initial matter, those sorts of particular issues with respect to specific redactions are the sort of things that the district court can face in the first instance with the material actually in front of it and assessing the arguments of the parties. And that didn't happen with Judge Green's order.
What if the district court said what I just said, which is, gee, I don't know. There's a list of 10 people who supposedly were at this camp, one of whom is the detainee here. And I don't know whether those other 9, I have no idea which way the other 9 would testify, or whether the other 9 are actually also detainees, or whether they would provide an alibi for the. And if that's all the court said, would that be enough to require turning that over? We're only talking about, at this point, we're only talking about turning it over to a security cleared counsel, correct? That's the only issue before us right now.
Yes.
Yeah. Would that be enough?
I think the court, consistent with Stillman and with this court's decision in Giffrey and some language in the Ellsberg decision, the court has to try to resolve the case without the assistance of counsel, even in those circumstances. And it will have tools, and the government welcomes the opportunity to show to the court why either evidence might not be material, which was the claim here with respect to the large lists of individuals, or whether evidence might be reliable. The government can make a showing of reliability to the court with respect to that. All of that taking incremental steps to accommodate these national security interests.
Sort of a specific hypothetical, which just by luck happens to be the one you posed. Imagine that there is a list of 10 people at a camp, one of whom is a detainee, the other are 9 others. How is the judge supposed to know And what is the argument that the judge could figure out some other way? I suppose if you had evidence that each of those confessed that they were at the camp, that would be different.
But in the absence of
that, how is a judge going to know that?
It's hard for me to speculate what sort of things the government could show with respect to that document. And obviously, the materiality issue is a step also. As well as substitutions. I'm not sure how substitutions would work in that circumstance, but the government would certainly consider it.
What substitute could you give for the other witnesses at the?
I don't know. I'm not sure if that's possible.
You're not taking the position that evidence that a court couldn't say, I'm unable to determine whether this is material or not, and for that reason I need the help of detainees' counsel.
Actually, I think the proper result is if the court says, I cannot determine if this is reliable or not.
Not reliable. Whether this
material.
Might provide an alibi.
Whether it's material?
Yes.
Well, once the court determines it's material, it still has to try to resolve the case ex parte. That's the kind of the instruction from Stillman, which Bismullah cited.
Well, the instruction from Stillman is in a very different circumstance. Stillman's a case about publication of a.
Sure, but this court.
No one's liberty was at issue in Stillman.
I agree.
He didn't have a constitutional right to habeas at issue in Stillman. So I appreciate that it has relevance, but it's not decisive.
Before we get in onto the liberty interests and that the due process clause, I'd like to point out if the court ultimately concludes, look, I cannot, this is material, and I can't, the government hasn't convinced me it's reliable ex parte, the solution is the court does not give the evidence weight. It's not that the court gives it to the other side.
I'm talking about the weight part. In many of these cases, your only evidence is somebody's testimony that they were at a camp doing certain things. And if you're not going to give that any weight, then you have no evidence. So I don't think you want to take the position that evidence goes out completely.
The government will try very hard to convince the district court that if there is a source identifying document that can't be turned over.
I'm trying to focus not on that element. We'll get to that point. I'm focusing on the other category, the category that is not sensitive information by your own concession and that might provide witnesses to the facts that are at issue.
The information is all sensitive. It's all national security sensitive information.
It's all secret.
Yeah.
But it is not all of the particularly secret kind of evidence which you're putting in the category of source identifying, correct?
With respect to, I think, information that, as we portrayed it, pertains to someone other than the detainee,
yes.
The government rejected it more on a relevance or materiality basis.
The contention of the detainees is that it is a potential source of evidence for them, and if I understand you correctly, you now agree to the proposition that the district court should look at it and make some judgment as to ways of making sure that withholding it from detainees' counsel does not cripple the detainees' possible position.
Yeah. So our point is the district court should take several steps before getting to that ultimate question, and that didn't happen here. And in cases where it does happen, hopefully the government, working with the court, can come up with tools to resolve the factual issue that won't necessitate that Hobson's choice. But we just haven't gotten there with the order that's on appeal here. We haven't even gotten close.
You're not going to put all the weight on the certification by an FBI, either on-scene commander or assistant general counsel, that the detainees have no need to know this list of people. That's not going to be a you've cited this certification, which in our appendix is nothing more than one sentence, which says that detainees have no need to know this because it wouldn't help their case.
The government in particular situations is, of course, perfectly willing to explain to the district court in more detail why specific things are harmful, why it has made the need-to-know determination. That explanation might also have to be ex parte.
Why shouldn't that explanation have attended the production of the ex parte information rather than waiting until after? That is, wouldn't it have been, we're 6 years away from, 4 years away from when this happened, so if you're asking us to make sort of rules for the future, wouldn't it make sense for the government to have to explain, not just produce something with a statement by a quite low-level lawyer at the FBI, say, no disparagement of low-level lawyers, but nonetheless, no reason, and not suggesting that you are, and no evidence that they would really have any idea as to whether this would be helpful. But rather, if you want something, as we said in Parhat, if the government wants something protected, they should explain why, not just simply say, this is what we want protected.
This was done a long time ago, and the current practice, if I can explain to the court, is to not have a delta between what is going into the returns and what is being provided to opposing counsel. That doesn't mean that every intelligence document doesn't have redactions in it now. It just means the court and the counsel are getting the same thing and asked to try and make a judgment on that basis. That's also not to say that these disputes are not going to arise. Judge Hogan's order anticipates them. Judge Leon this week had a hearing on the government's desire to put in a rebuttal exhibit that the government thought was essential to its case, but that it could not provide to the other side. So these issues are definitely going to arise. I think rather than what we have here, they're going to be much more specific, much more targeted, and there's going to be more of the sort of justification that you anticipate.
There are passages of your brief which at least could be read as asserting that separation of powers is such that once the government says that an item cannot be disclosed, that is the end of it. But everything you've said in this, all these colloquies, suggests that the government's assertion is no more than the beginning of the process. Have I read you correctly?
I think at the beginning of a process where the government is trying its best to accommodate interests here, if a court comes to the ultimate point where it says, information has to be provided to the other side, and the government says we simply can't do that consistent with national security, then we'll have sort of that constitutional problem, and it's a serious one, we submit. But we haven't gotten there in this case for sure, and I don't think the cases in district court have yet gotten to that point. The district courts, I think, are trying to find solutions. Every judge is struggling with these issues.
When you say it's a constitutional problem, is it the production of the material that you regard as the problem over the government's objection, or the judge's determination that the case cannot continue without the production of the material? That is, does a constitutional problem go away if the court says, well, the government says that it cannot produce this evidence, I, the court, regard this evidence as exculpatory, and therefore, if the government will not permit it to be provided to the defense or to be used in the hearing, and the government's case has to end. Is that a constitutional problem?
You have a pair of constitutional problems. One, it's a compelling interest of the executive to be able to hold enemies in this war that Congress has authorized. And at the same time, you have the compelling interest in preserving the secrecy of national security information in judgments that the executive largely must make. So when forced, I think when if the executive is forced to choose one.
You left out one more constitutional interest, which the Supreme Court stated about 10 times in Boumediene, right? What is that?
Well, of course, the habeas interest, the habeas suspension clause interest.
Right. In which the court said the framers deemed the writ to be an essential mechanism in the separation of powers scheme. So we can't exactly leave that out.
Sure, but it is essential scheme. It's an essential mechanism in separation of powers. It's for the judiciary to put a check on the executive branch's decision to detain, and if the judiciary declines to look at the government's true cause of detention, the evidence that the government has that actually explains why it's detaining someone, we would submit the judiciary has a duty to look at that, even if it is so sensitive it can't be provided to a civilian counsel.
But that's a different question than the one I'm asking. I understand the point you're saying. If there is evidence that is clearly reliable, that the judge thinks there's no way the defense can rebut, that's one matter. But what we're talking about here is something different. We're talking about, again, the hypothetical raised, I think, by both parties, which is imagine the supersensitive source is someone who the newspapers report, or even that the administration concedes, was interrogated by methods which don't necessarily result in reliable statements, and that the court does not know this. That is, the court can't possibly know what happened with every witness that you are citing, unless you're providing that information. I don't see any evidence of that. So it may be that the court would say, well, I don't know whether this is a reliable source or not, and I need help from opposing counsel in order to make that determination. So that it's not that I don't want to look at this information. It's that I do not know whether this information is reliable.
I think two things have to happen. First, the court's got to come to the government and say, look, I cannot rely on this document. You haven't shown the court that this is reliable because I don't know who the source is. I don't know what happened to the source. I don't know if the source was provided information under coercive circumstances. And the government has to be given the opportunity to make that showing in an ex parte manner so as to preserve national security. If that process carries out and the court's still not convinced, the court simply has to make a weight determination, and if the government cannot convince the court that the evidence is reliable, then the court's not going to rely on it. That is not only kind of what we think habeas calls for in these circumstances. I think it also helps resolve the due process issues. Now, of course, the government's position is that there's no liberty interest in these cases, that it's protected by the due process clause under Verdugo and Eisentrager.
Do you see a difference? I thought the government's position that whatever the due process clause might provide is provided by constitutional habeas anyway, so the difference between those two, there may not be any space between those two. Is that wrong or right?
I'm not sure how that carries out. Boumediene talked about due process providing a guideline for habeas, for whether habeas could be suspended, but then it sort of rejected that in the next portion of the opinion. So I'm not sure how that falls out, but the government certainly thinks that if there is a liberty interest here, that this process that the government's proposing and that this court has employed in cases where there are due process protected interests is satisfied. In cases like the terrorist designation cases in Giffrey, the court looked at material ex parte, much more critical material, with very little or nothing being provided to the other side, and said that ex parte review.
Those were all cases in which nobody was being detained.
But the backstop is the court said ex parte review resolves concerns about risk of error. And that is what we have to rely on often when something cannot be shared with the other side. Additionally, I think we have to look at the various interests at stake in the wartime context. Hamdi directed the courts to do that. One thing about wartime is that it sometimes involves long-term detention, often detention of people who are determined to be in the fight overseas. There are thousands detained in Afghanistan and Iraq. Millions were detained in World War II for being part of the fight. And detention is often the least damaging alternative in these circumstances where war abroad results in contact with the enemy. So the liberty interest is very significant if there is a liberty interest, but it has to be looked at in that context. At the same time, I've already tried to explain the government's interest, compelling ones in protecting information and in successfully carrying out the war. And ultimately, this court can address concerns about risk of error through ex parte review.
Thank you, Mr. Flinch.
Thank you.
Mr. Reeves, a chance.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Could you just start on that one jurisdictional question?
Yes, sir.
Is there any relevance that you see to the decision by Judge Hogan to whether or not we have jurisdiction over this interlocutory?
I don't believe that there's any jurisdictional significance to the order. Okay. I'm David Reams. This is my colleague, Alan Pemberton of Covington and Burling, and also in attendance is our able legal assistant, J.J. Huber. I would like to begin, if I may, by bringing these theoretical questions down to their practical application. I think Judge Garland had it just right when he said the court is sitting here, or suggested that the court is sitting here to establish rules for the future. These cases have been pending since February 2002, and it is simply not consistent with the Supreme Court's admonition that habeas is a meaningful remedy, or its injunction that these habeas cases must proceed expeditiously for the government to be able to go through the complex process that it describes in its briefs of having the court describe with particularity its justification for every redaction and then go and ask the court whether there are substitutions and take such other steps as the government describes.
I think all that should be thrown aside, that you're actually saying that the substantive position should be that relevancy alone entitles counsel to the material?
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's
not a standard applied in Eunice, which involves a case of finding someone to be a criminal, right, with all the implications that finding someone to be a criminal entails.
But, Your Honor, the question ultimately boils down to the possibility that without the review, there'll be no, without the disclosure, there'll be no remedy.
The government clearly acknowledges the existence of the of that possibility, and it advocates a procedure by which the court is able to preserve interests in national security at the same time as preserving the detainee's interests in not being held without reason.
That's correct, Judge Williams, and we certainly do not advocate a rule that would never be that would never have an exception made to it, but I think that one of Your Honors, perhaps it was Judge Garland, perhaps it was yourself, Your Honor, made the point that these justifications for withholding the classified information should be made at the threshold, not down the road. That is to say, when the government proposes to redact information and withhold it to counsel, as part of the request, it must justify the request on the ground that there is available an agreeable substitute materiality.
I'm suggesting that as an ideal procedure, but are you contending that because such a procedure was not in place at the time that these forwarding of documents to the court occurred, that the government has forever lost any entitlement to claim to claim national security interests to keep the information from defense, from detainees counsel?
I would submit that the rule I'm proposing should apply to the amended returns filed by the government following the Boumediene case, which changed the legal landscape to the extent that it recognized a constitutional right to habeas corpus and the need for expedited review.
You're not talking about the documents in this case. You're talking about a rule for the future.
Yes. With respect to the documents in this case, I would say that relevance is sufficient because there's no other way that a detainee can defend himself if his lawyer does not have access.
That wasn't considered enough in Eunice.
This wasn't clear to me that I don't know, sometimes lawyers on both sides want to make more of a difference than there is. I'm looking at page 7 of your response to the appellant's supplemental brief, your footnote about the difference between materiality and relevance, and your suggestion that Judge Gregory's concurrence in Almari might be the way to go. And in that, in Almari, he suggested using SEPA as an acceptable framework. And of course, our interpretation, I think the Fourth Circuit's and maybe everybody else's interpretation of SEPA has been that the information has to be material, that material is not exactly the same as relevance, that material means it must be useful to the detainee or the defendant in a criminal case, but also taking into consideration whether the district court feels that it on its own can determine that question. Is there really a difference here? Is your position really that relevance read as meaning nothing more than pertaining to is the right? And I'm not saying that was Judge Green's standard, but as we define the difference between relevance and materiality in Eunice, are you suggesting we should ignore that for purposes of the detention cases?
I believe Your Honor is correct that it is really a distinction without a difference in this context.
That is, it may be that Judge Green really did apply materiality. We don't know.
I think Judge Green's decision with respect to the disclosure of information in this case should be read against the backdrop of her discussion of the flaws of the CSRT process in her decision to grant in part and deny in part the defendant's motion to dismiss. There, she was very emphatic about the unfairness of the system where the detainee has no counsel and no right to see the evidence against him. That is clearly a problem in her mind that would satisfy any materiality requirement to the extent that there were a difference between materiality and relevance.
We have the same problem in SEPA. And you're not saying that the standard in this case should be more in favor of the detainees than the standard in a criminal case would be in favor of the defendant, are you?
No.
All right. So you would like to have it the same rights that a defendant has?
Yes, sir.
All right. So we've held in Eunice, there's another opinion called Mejia, there's Rizak, all of these cases which apply something that actually sounds like both sides agree to. That is, government has some information that they regard as super sensitive. They provide that ex parte to the court with an explanation for why it can't be provided and why it isn't material. The court looks at it. The court makes a determination of whether the court can make that determination without help. The court then thinks about whether there should be substitutes or admissions instead. And at the end of that process, if the court thinks that it's material or can't decide, then the court says to the government, I have to have the defense counsel cleared, defense counsel see this. Now, this could all take, you know, an hour at the bench. This doesn't have to be a long process. This back and forth can be a discussion. But do you disagree with that kind of approach?
No, I don't, Your Honor. Our interest is in having the decision made quickly that the detainee have a fair opportunity to avoid indefinite detention without even being convicted of a crime, and that the government not be able to put off the habeas case indefinitely by a succession of appeals from every single order entered by the judge. I also want to, again, as I mentioned, be practical about this. The government uses such language as highly sensitive material. Since the briefing of this case, I've had the opportunity to review about a dozen amended returns that were filed in our case, and I believe that it is not going too far to say that the information that the government seeks to redact in these amended returns consists primarily, if not exclusively, or overwhelmingly, of statements made by other detainees that implicate the detainee in question, or lists of a series of other detainees, which, as Judge Garland points out, could be highly material to whether the list itself.
I think you already have a concession from government counsel that at least as to the list, they're not withholding on the grounds of being highly sensitive. They're withholding on the grounds of no need to know. Now, that obviously that's going to be a debatable question, but that second category is, at least they're now conceding, and I don't think it's a new concession. It seemed quite clear in the briefs and quite clear in their original statement that it was a different category.
Yes, and with respect to the sources themselves, we're not talking about moles for the United States at the highest echelons of a foreign government. We're not talking about satellite technology or eavesdropping equipment and the like. We're talking about statements made by other detainees who are either being detained as enemy combatants or have been detained as enemy combatants. And I simply submit to you, Your Honors, that to the extent that's the case, it's not plausible or legitimate to characterize these sources as highly sensitive. So I simply want to try to brush away some of the hyperbole here.
Some of this seems to be, history is a very short period since this case began, but the government's resistance to turning over some of this material occurred at a time before Boumediene had established this right and before the government had had experience in producing other things. Doesn't seem to me unlikely that the government will have a different view about how much of this has to be left away from the detainees' counsel were it to be considering these issues for the first time now and or if they were to be considering it on remand.
Well, Your Honor, I read the government's briefs to continue to argue that it has the right to, that the very sources that it's redacting in these amended returns are highly sensitive intelligence sources. They're not, I respectfully submit, highly sensitive intelligence sources. They are other prisoners who may have been tortured into giving admissions or may have been coerced into giving admissions. They're not, we're not dealing with foreign espionage.
The playing out of that argument is one that would occur before the district court under the procedure that the government appears to advocate.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm simply cautioning this court to beware that this is what we're talking about in practical effect, because the court may otherwise give credence to the notion that these sources are somehow on a par with the type of sources you'd find in a James Bond movie. That's my only point, Your Honor. I think that the deepest problem here in considering one aspect of this case is that the district court often cannot know, perhaps most often in these cases cannot know, whether or not the information the government wants to redact will be material. That's one of the most difficult things in this case. I'd submit that Judge Hogan's order is helpful to the extent that it offers explicitly a choice for the court to preclude the government from relying on the information that it wants to redact. That is certainly one alternative approach for the district court to take. And by that, I don't read his language to mean that the government can't rely on the redacted information, but could rely on substitutions if the redacted information is deemed to be important to assure that the detainee has a fair chance to demonstrate that the evidence is invalid. But I think it's helpful, and SEPA itself provides for remedies that can protect the government's interest in not
this. I'm sorry, which provides
SEPA?
SEPA. But SEPA is not directly applicable, right?
No, sir. It's
we have a somewhat different set of interests involved
here. We do, but I still believe that in general, SEPA entails a balancing of harms here, harms to the defendant and right. harms to the government, and that's all I'm suggesting here, that there is a remedy short of requiring disclosure, and that's from precluding right. the government from relying on the evidence.
There seems to be full agreement on the basic procedure that needs to be followed.
Yes, that's true, but I believe that the one thing that Judge Hogan's order does not do, and that the district court would provide, would benefit from guidance from this court, are what perhaps might be considered generic rules going forward. For example, that the district court, that the identities of accusers who are also detainees at Guantanamo shall be presumed not properly to be redacted, and the government has to offer particularized, compelling justification for withholding those identities. And the government also has to be able to make certain representations under oath, supported by affidavits showing personal knowledge, that the...
You're sort of asking us, you know, we have a particular case in front of us, as you know. We're not the case management panel for all these cases. I don't think we have such a thing. Bismula was the closest we had to that, but all we have is one set of cases ahead in front of us, and it's maybe asking something that's beyond our authority to draw up essentially a protective order, which is really what you're asking for. We can say, in you know, what the law requires. We can say the general kinds of procedures that both parties appear to agree to, but requirements that are really specified, for example, in Judge Hogan's, you know, this has to be done within 5 days, and there has to be an affidavit attached to it. It goes somewhat beyond the least typical thing that the Court of Appeals panels do. Is that wrong?
Well, Your Honor, I misunderstood you when you were talking about the need to provide rules for the future that would provide for expeditious treatment of these cases. It will not be in keeping with the Boumediene decision for different district court judges to apply essentially different standards in these habeas cases.
If the Supreme Court were interested in a uniform treatment, it would have left the CSRT and review here process go on without habeas, right? Because except for some what appeared to be hypothetical gaps in that procedure, there was a system for producing uniform judicial treatment.
Your Honor, that's correct, but it also has to be a constitutional system. And here we have an unconstitutional system. We're trying to find ways to move the system forward as expeditiously as possible. And district courts should receive at least some guidance from this court that they should view skeptically claims that information should be redacted when the information simply refers to individuals at Guantanamo or who have been to Guantanamo who are making statements that implicate the defendant. We don't believe that such general guidance is beyond the province of this court.
I mean, if the government is arguing, it's not clear to me that they are anymore, but if the government is arguing that there is no need to know the list of other witnesses present at the camp because they're not the same as the detainee, we could certainly say that that's not correct, that a list of witnesses could be quite material, and the district court needs to consider that. I didn't mean by saying that we can't issue a management order that we can't make statements about the law, but there are some elements of what you're asking for which maybe go beyond what we can do. But it does appear that there's enormous amount of agreement between both sides as to what the process should be here, and it doesn't appear that you disagree with that.
Not when stated in such broad and general terms.
Well, you agree that the government should, the government has this material that they want to submit ex parte. I'm just going to say what I said before, that they should present that to the district court with an explanation for why it needs to be kept in camera, that the district court needs to evaluate it for materiality or to determine whether or not the district court can decide materiality without your help, that at that point the district court can either order substitutions or admissions, and if that's not good enough, at some point the district court can say to the government, well, we have to have the assistance of opposing counsel. And at that point, unless the government has something that will persuade the court that the evidence is just too secret to be provided, it can order it. And if it says it's just too secret to provide it, maybe we have the constitutional issue, which we don't have here. But that general sort of process, which follows from what you want, which is SEPA and the application of Eunice and the application of Judge Gregory's opinion in Almari, doesn't appear that the government disagrees, and I take it you don't disagree.
No, Your Honor, but the devil is...
No, I don't disagree.
No, I don't disagree, Your Honor. But the devil is in the details here. Yeah. We submit...
The way this case has come up, we don't have many details before us.
That's true, but in the spirit of providing guidance to the district courts and sort of a case management perspective, and this goes to the point that one of you made regarding the general one-line certification by a government official or a government lawyer, I would submit that the government should be required at the threshold to provide a particularized showing and justification for withholding the particular identity of a source that is a classified identity. It must demonstrate at the threshold that there are substitutions that are available, or that it will not rely on this evidence or does not rely on this evidence to support the enemy combatant determination. These shouldn't be post hoc.
Not relying doesn't necessarily give you everything you want, because this might be evidence that helped you.
That's true, Your Honor. I withdraw the suggestion.
All right. We have no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Reed.
Thank you, sir.
We'll hear again from the government.
A few quick points. Boumediene directed the courts to accommodate national security to the greatest extent possible, and in doing so, it cited the Bismoula litigation, which dealt with this issue. The other side agrees that the Bismoula standard is appropriate, and while there are a lot of thorny questions to be decided based on particular evidence and particular issues that will arise, I think the district court's order is not consistent with what this court said in Bismoula, so should be reversed with
What way is that. It not consistent?
The district court order?
Yes.
Well, the district court order used a logical relevant standard, or even a relevant standard, and Bismoula didn't speak to relevance. In fact, it was dealing with information it found to be relevant and nonetheless had a national security-based standard for providing some material ex parte.
Well, I don't know. I'm not saying this may be an area where you don't want to completely follow Bismoula, but Bismoula said all the government's information. It didn't say just material information. It said all the government's information, right? Had to
with
be
respect to the, I mean, that was the record in those cases. Here the government would be submitting a factual return, and that would be the information
I understand that, but
to justify detention.
The relevance materiality question, it's not clear whether it's consistent or inconsistent with Bismoula, because it really wasn't addressed. Which aspect of Bismoula do you think is violated here?
The Bismoula part addressing whether there could be ex parte material submitted to the court.
You think Bismoula stands for the proposition that once it's submitted ex parte, the court can't then determine, based on all the different kinds of procedures we've been talking about, can't in the end be disclosed?
We don't think it's consistent with a court ordering national security sensitive material disclosed.
Ever or just on a basis of relevance?
Certainly not on the basis of relevance.
Right.
I've gone through kind of the steps, and the court described them pretty during the other side's argument.
You agree with those steps as well? The ones described, the ones that Mr. Reams said he agreed with?
Most of them. I think at the end, there will be a very difficult question if you can't resolve it by going through the steps, if you get to the point where
No court has spoken to that in the context of detainees. I'm not sure any court has spoken of it in the context of SEPA, but...
You mean the last step?
The last step, right.
The last step... there are some cases dealing with bail where courts have held that a court can rely ex parte on information relating on dangerousness in bail cases. Acevedo Ramos in the
Bail's
First Circuit.
Different where you have a trial right and so forth.
I'm not saying they're the same. And of course, Bismoula itself dealt with this very situation. And the court thought that some ex parte submissions would be appropriate. Just like a couple more points, if possible. SEPA provides a model on kind of using substitutions, but it's not appropriate to apply in full to these cases. Both Hamdi and Boumediene said criminal procedures were not appropriate. And ultimately, in this context, a court can resolve material factual issues ex parte in some circumstances, and that would not be allowed by SEPA. The other side talked about kind of the statements of other detainees and lists of, and Judge Garland, you've talked about lists of detainees. It's my understanding that in the factual returns being filed now, in most circumstances, other detainee identities are not being withheld. I don't know the practice on lists of detainees.
So with respect to what is the large amount of the percentage anyway of the material that is redacted here, at least my intuition was the government might have a different view now, having had all this experience, that it might not be redacting the same amount of material.
Well, the other side was basing his points on seeing amended returns in some of the cases, so I think there's the government's using a somewhat different standard now for determining, answering those questions.
So if we were to remand the order, there is at least a reasonable possibility that the government would not say that the lists, I'm not talking about the super secret sources, but that the list of other detainees had to continue to be redacted.
I don't know the answer to that. I could get the court more information on the list of detainees if the court would like it.
Actually, I would. If there are obviously two sets of categories of information that the government has redacted here in pink on my copy.
I do want to.
And some of that, and a significant amount of that, is simply lists of other detainees or other people present, you know, at Tora Bora or at a camp or something like that. And it would be, I think, useful to us to know whether the government no longer feels that that information needs to be redacted, redacted in the sense from opposing counsel.
The government will be happy to provide some to the court. I do want to stress a list doesn't necessarily only fall into that one not relevant type interest. I mean, a list could create risk for other reasons if there were.
I understand.
If it was source identifying or.
I understand that. To the extent that the list has been withheld only on the grounds of the government's view about need to know and not on the grounds of sensitivities greater than the kind of information you are now routinely sharing with counsel, you would do a lot to narrow the gap here by telling us that that information you no longer would object to being provided to counsel.
We'll file something with the court on that. I'm out of time. I just want to stress the parties have both agreed Bismula is an appropriate way to analyze these issues in the first instance. Because the district courts are moving very quickly on some of these issues, including the order from Judge Hogan that we don't really take a position on what exactly it provides, some clarification that Bismula is a good model for the start of this process would be very helpful, and we request that. Thank you.
Our speed may be somewhat dependent on your speed in responding to my questions. So
do so promptly.
In any event, we're bound by Bismula.
Absolutely.
So we could hardly say that some other procedure was in order.
Well, the court's bound by Bismula, and Boumediene, the sort of most important intervening precedent, cited Bismula on this very point of accommodating source and highly sensitive information national security interests. So the court cited that litigation. So I think the Supreme Court would have expected that would kind of end up being the result in habeas cases. That, along with the D.C. Circuit's other case law on these issues, taking incremental steps as Hamdi instructed. Thank you.
Okay. Case is submitted. Thanks, counsel on both sides.